Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Again, I want to remind everyone we Zoom on Thursday so the show can air on Friday. The Bolton book has just been released. I heard people talking about Colonel Vindman and about his courage, and that Bolton showed no courage, that he wasn't willing to be forthcoming because he wanted to make money on a book that was just released. Well, for months now, we've begun this show with the powerful testimony of the courageous Lieutenant Colonel Vindman at the impeachment hearings of 2019. This day, we reflect on his courage and we're grateful for it. We begin again with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
If it's Friday, it must be Scott Braddock. If it's Scott Braddock, it's the editor of the Quorum Report. It's the voice of Texas. It's the dean of the Austin Press Corps. We have learned so much about the great state of Texas because, as we've come to expect, as Texas goes, so goes the nation, for good or bad. Anyway, joining us right now on actually Thursday, we Zoom everyone on Thursday, but this show will air on June 19th, Juneteenth. And it is completely and totally appropriate, Scott Braddock, that you are joining us and this show will air on Juneteenth because the story of Juneteenth is a story of Galveston, Texas. And I would love to have you sort of give us a little sort of input or insight about this holiday that virtually every African-American may be familiar with, but most whites are not in this country. And just to give you a point of information, do you know that for the first time ever, Google put June 19th on their calendar? They had never done it before.
I wonder why. Interesting. Well, Juneteenth, the origin story is in Galveston, Texas. It was 2 years, it was more than 2 years after slaves had been officially freed by law. But on the Texas Gulf Coast, they did not learn that until 2 years later on June 19th. The Union Army General Gordon Granger read the federal orders to the now liberated black people who lived in Galveston, Texas, which, Arnie, if I can just say one thing. Galveston is one of my favorite places on the whole planet. It's one of my happy places. And I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why, but I want you to know that for African Americans in Texas, it's a sacred sort of thing. It was only put into the law much more recently, that Juneteenth would be honored and established. A former member of the Texas House wrote the bill from the Houston area that established it. Just a very, very interesting civil rights moment. I mean, you think about the fact that these folks were free by law for 2 years. But people, of course, this is how this stuff works. I mean, just because something happened, and this will happen now if there are reforms that people aren't aware of, it's always a question of, do you even know your rights? These folks didn't know their rights for 2 years, right? We live in a different era where, if something had changed dramatically, people would know about that instantly on social media and on cable news and all of that. Galveston is, if it's not my favorite place, it's number one or two. Maybe it wrestles for a couple of other places in the state. But I'll tell you, Galveston, when folks think about Galveston and Houston, obviously Houston is the giant city. It's the fourth largest city in the United States, the most diverse city.
I thought Juneteenth was Houston, but it's Galveston.
Well, yeah, and it's the Catholic diocese, the archdiocese of the area is the Archdiocese of Galveston, Houston. Galveston comes first. And the reason Galveston comes first is because it's one of those places, and I think this is analogous to the African American experience in the United States. It's one of those places that was supposed to be the big city. If the hurricane of 1900 had not happened and hadn't wiped out hundreds and hundreds of people who were living there, if, let's just say, hurricanes weren't a thing, and let's say being beaten down for no reason wasn't a thing. If hurricanes weren't a thing, it would look like Manhattan today. It would be skyscrapers from one end of the island to the other, because it was on track to be that. It, you know, it was the big port city. It was sort of the Ellis Island of the South. It's where all of these various immigrants who made their way to Houston, to Southeast Texas over the years, Vietnamese, Asian immigrants, Czech immigrants, and the rest, came into Texas through Galveston, again, Ellis Island of the South. And when you walk around on Galveston Island, which I love to do, I'm actually going down to Rockport, Texas this weekend. I may drive back up to Galveston just because we're having this conversation, only a couple of hours away. When you walk around downtown Galveston, you get the feeling that this is a place that never got to be what it was supposed to. It's sort of an eerie feeling, but the people there who live there, so much of the history, it's a big point of pride. It was also for a long time run by the mafia, much like Las Vegas, and the Texas gangsters who ran Galveston years ago also in a lot of ways held the city back from what it should be because of the way they ran the place. But I can tell you that the story of Juneteenth, and I'm glad you're giving it, it's full deserving honor here. It's a very important moment in civil rights, because learning that you are free and learning that you don't have to do what that guy tells you anymore, and he's not legally allowed to beat you anymore, because, and you're not his property anymore.
You're not chattel.
It's not right, and it never was right. And now the government's recognizing that it's not right. And for you to learn that is a huge moment.
You also mentioned something before that we started recording the show about the Republican Party in Texas and the African-American experience. Please thread that together too, because I just noted that the Southern Baptist Conference just chose their first Black executive director. So the first person to run it is a Black pastor. And I was like, wow, times are changing. And I mean, it's 2020. And when I think Southern Baptist, I actually think a lot of African-Americans are Southern Baptists. And yet it took this long for someone to actually be, you know, chosen as the leader of the Southern Baptist Conference. But you mentioned something about African Americans and the GOP in Texas, and there also is a connection.
Yes, Norris Wright Cuney was the first chairman of the Republican Party of Texas, African American, and I'm going to forward you his book. We have time to sit around and read now, right, Arnie? Born in Hempstead, Texas, years ago, he was a United States Collector of Customs in 1889 in Galveston. And he was the highest ranking appointed person of any African American in the South in the 19th century. And the reason that they founded the party and they wanted to support Lincoln, of course, was because of the move toward ending slavery and freedom for Black people. He wanted to pick that torch up and run with it here in Texas. And so, you know, when I talk to folks who are African American Republicans, and we talked about this a little bit last week here on the show, after you look at the way the party was founded, based on freedom for African American people, to see what's going on in the party now, where they're having to tell Republican Party county chairmen all across Texas, at least a dozen of them, you need to get out of this party because of racist memes that they've been sharing on social media. One of the Republican chairmen in Texas, a chairwoman from Bear County, Cynthia Bream, they were asking her, including, by the way, the top leadership, Governor Abbott and Lieutenant Governor Patrick, were asking her to resign because she had said on Facebook that maybe the death of George Floyd was just a staged up thing to make Donald Trump look bad, as if that's the only thing that's making Donald Trump look bad.
We won't even mention the Bolton book.
Oh, well, that's the next thing, right, Arnie? But yeah. Because of this history of civil rights, is very married to Galveston County on the Texas Gulf Coast. It's something to be proud of as part of our heritage. And, you know, when you hear all these people talk about, honoring our heritage, it's often code for, you know, the Confederacy,
right,
honoring what's white, basically, not what's right, but what's white. And you look at some of the stuff that has gone on lately with the civil unrest all around the country. Just this week here in Austin, the Austin City Council painted the words "Black Austin Matters" on the street. A lot of cities have been doing this Black Lives Matter. Of course, Austin has not grown up enough yet to just put Black Lives Matter on the street. They had to put Black Austin Matters. And of course, this is the same city that just 2 weeks ago, the Austin Police Department was, you know, shooting protesters with pepper spray. And I think they hit a pregnant woman in the belly with one of those beanbags, which when they say beanbag, Arnie, it ain't a beanbag like you're thinking about. That sucker comes out of the end of a shotgun. That can do some damage. You've probably seen the pictures of that on social media. And of course, Austin has a long history of being a very segregated city, you know, for all races. I mean, one of the criticisms, longtime criticism in Austin is that if Austin is a place that has so many Hispanics, where do they live? The interstate that runs through Austin, Interstate 35, which is the, you know, it runs from here in Texas all the way up to Canada, Minneapolis, 35 through Austin. The reason it runs through the part of town it runs through is because they were making sure that there wouldn't be a Black neighborhood there. I mean, so we have it's like a scar, like the freeway is a scar across the city. And this was purposefully done by people who, you know, now would say white liberals, right? And so there's a lot to atone for. And it's not just on the conservative side. I mean, it was only more recently in the last decade, Arnie, that this city, like other cities in Texas, like Houston and Dallas, moved to single member districts for their city council. I mean, city council members in Austin, up until recently, were elected citywide, which is not the way to do it if you want to have equal representation of all the different neighborhoods and therefore the different racial minorities of the city. We finally moved toward that. And of course,
within a community.
Because there's communities within the community, and now they feel that they're more represented at City Hall. That leads to all sorts of other strife. But I can tell you that, and you know, some of these fights are good because then you have it out and we try to figure out, you know, how we're going to move forward. But, you know, electing council members citywide, really, in the quote, most progressive city in Texas, we only did away with that just recently. And of course, I would say privately, the white liberals would say, man, things sure ran better when we got to elect people city. And what they meant was they were putting white liberals down
so
at City Hall.
Before we get into Governor
and of course,
Abbott,
that was one of the reasons that.
Right. And I want to get into Governor Abbott and mask wearing, but I just want to make a comment as you were talking about Austin. We had a professor from Hamline University on talking to us about the Twin Cities, especially Minneapolis. And he said that Minneapolis is a tale of two cities. The Black experience in Minneapolis and the white experience in Minneapolis. And Minneapolis is perceived as being a very liberal, enlightened city, you know, exactly how you're describing Austin. And I could do a split screen right now and had Dave over here and had Scott over here, you would not know which city you were talking about because they sounded identical. And it's the white liberals that pride themselves on, look what we've done. And yet, as you point out in Austin, where do the Hispanics live? Oh my God, that statement just cut me to the quick because it's important for people to know that as we move beyond Juneteenth, which we will never move beyond, I think this Juneteenth will change all the Juneteenths going into the future, and that is a good thing. Let's talk a little bit about your state because we're seeing significant spikes in COVID.
Let's come back to COVID. Can we stay with civil rights for a second? We have we have breaking news here on the show as we tape
on
Thursday.
And reminding everyone, Thursday morning, we're Zooming for Friday today, I guess.
The United States Supreme Court rules against the Trump administration in the challenge to end deferred action for childhood arrivals. This allowed non-citizens brought to this country illegally as children to apply for protection from deportation, as you know. The Supreme Court...
What was the vote?
Said that the decision by the Trump administration to end the program, which of course was started by President Obama, the decision to end it was, quote, arbitrary and capricious. Now, let's take a minute to talk about the...
What was the vote?
I'm looking here, Arnie. This is just breaking.
Oh, my God.
As we get to this. I'm seeing this on the SCOTUS blog right now.
Okay. Does it say what the number was? Because we just had that amazing LGBTQ 6-3 vote with Gorsuch writing the opinion and blowing everyone away. I mean, I listened to the GLAD attorney who was like, I can't believe it. I can't believe it. And it's so clean and simple and straightforward. So does the SCOTUS blog say what the vote was? That's important to me because, you know, I know that Justice Roberts is now kind of the pivotal vote. So it'll be 5-4.
Right.
What I'm hoping is that Gorsuch, also a Trump appointee, is finding his judicial spine, not his political spine. Not his, I am grateful you appointed me to the Federalist Society and to Donald Trump, but something much bigger and much deeper than that. So I'm kind of curious as to how the vote came down.
I am trying to find the vote here.
All right. Well,
this is
Stephanie, start looking on start Googling, Stephanie. See if you can find out what the vote was coming out.
If you can find the vote, I think that it's such breaking news, Arnie, that we don't even have the vote just yet. While we're talking about it, remember what the requirements are for DACA. If somebody was going to apply to be protected, and I think people get this mixed up. They get it twisted, as the kids say. They don't understand what DACA is if they're against it. Because once you explain what DACA is, and I do these speeches to Republican groups all over the place, all over in Texas, whether it's East Texas or West Texas or down Southeast Texas or wherever, you'll start out with folks who will say, well, these illegals, is the quote, these illegals ought to go home. What is it about illegal you don't understand? That's always the quote that you get. You have to understand that we're not even talking about something that is legal status for these kids. It doesn't grant them citizenship. All it does is keep them from being deported. That's it. And we're talking, and to be able to apply for that protection from deportation, which, remember, the reason this started is because President Obama was criticized by immigrant rights activists as the deporter in chief. He was deporting more people than President Bush had done. After President Bush had pushed, George W. Bush had pushed for immigration reform in about 2006, 2007. That's when the right wing of the Republican Party revolted against him. But the kids we're talking about under DACA, they have to be under the age of 31 as of 2012. They had to have come to the United States before they were 16 years old. They have to be in school or have graduated, obtained a certificate of completion from a high school like a GED. They have to either be in the military or be honorably discharged as a veteran of the Coast Guard or the Armed Forces. And they have to not have ever been convicted of a felony of significant misdemeanor or three or more misdemeanors. So we're talking about people with spotless records, other than the fact that their parents brought them to the United States when they were probably 3 or 4 years old. And of course, we all know that we are responsible for our own decisions when we're 3 and 4 years old. This is a huge, and by the way, I'm seeing this now.
I just found out it was penned by Roberts. So sounds like it might be a 5-4. That.
Probably a 5-4. It's amazing we're seeing this breaking news here. But this is a monumental thing. I mean, you have tens of thousands just here in Texas of DACA protectees. People talk about it as recipients. They don't get anything. They're not DACA recipients. They're DACA protectees. They're protected from deportation. The government's not going to go after them just because they don't have legal status. And how many people do I know, Arnie, who in this state, here in Austin, Houston, Dallas, et cetera, who are these kids? I grew up with some of these kids in Louise, Texas. One of them now lives in Georgia in the Atlanta area and is studying epidemiology. I guess they ought to round her up and send her back to Mexico. When I was a kid growing up on the farm in Southeast Texas, our bus, our public school bus would stop at the farms of white people. And there would be, you know, 6 or 7 Hispanic kids who would walk from a shack at the back of the farm, walk all the way, probably 100 acres to the front of the farm to get on the school bus and go to school with us. When I was a little kid, I didn't really realize what was going on. But of course, I know now. Those were people who were not documented. Probably their entire family was not documented, or some of their children were because they were born here. But it's a mix of people who have status and don't have status. Why should a grandmother be deported? Why should a kid be deported because they were brought here? It's not right. And I tell you this, you know, look at the fact, I was looking at this, Arnie, Joe Biden is trailing other Democrats historically with Latinos in Texas by as much as about 20 points. He's way behind where Clinton was and Obama was when they were running here. Part of it is, I think, that he's not speaking to the issues that really matter to Latinos, and it's not just immigration. Immigration, when I talk to Latinos all across the state, and this represents probably, you know, 15, 20 years of my reporting, when Latinos are deciding if they're going to vote for a Republican or a Democrat over that time period, it's not so much that the Democrat would be right about this issue, it's that the Republican would be wrong about it. Because if you poll Latinos, Rick Perry was right on the issue, Governor Bush was right on the issue. Governor Bush had famously said that family values don't end at the Rio Grande. If you look at the fact that up until 2006, the Republican share of the Latino vote in Texas was going up election after election until President Bush pushed that immigration reform bill, the right wing of the Republican Party revolted against him. They hijacked the issue. This is when you started to hear about it all the time on right wing talk radio, as the illegals ought to go home and all of that. And you would think that among those people, that if you would make the case, at least on the young immigrants who obviously didn't do anything wrong, they were brought here when they were very young. They're just trying to make their way in the United States, the only country they have ever known as their home. They don't remember living in Mexico. They don't remember living in South America or any of these other places, or Central America or any of that. But some of the people who you would make the case to, and you would outline all the requirements that I just told you about when it comes to the DACA children, it was a 5-4 decision, by the way. I'm seeing that from your producer. And like you said, not surprising. We've seen so many of these very divided decisions on the Supreme Court.
He's not a Kennedy of this court.
As it becomes more incumbent, because people have criticized the Supreme Court for being too partisan. You know why the Supreme Court is more partisan? Because the legislative branch has stopped doing its job on big issues. If the legislative branch would pass an immigration reform bill, get together and pass something. I mean, they can't even pass something on DACA. It was talking about kids who didn't do anything wrong, and they can't even get together about that. It was to say about some of these conservatives, when you would talk to them about the DACA children, they would say, well, it sounds like a teddy bear that's stuffed with a grenade, because these are illegals and they are here to sap us of all of it. And you say, say whatever.
Oh,
you want. It's all hateful and it's all ridiculous. But the Supreme Court has stepped in as a more partisan branch of government, because the branches of government that are set up to be partisan aren't doing their jobs. And you can see this even in the nominating process for the Supreme Court.
Right.
Well, for the Supreme Court, as the votes for Ruth Bader Ginsburg was voted in almost unanimously, even though she's, the lion of the left now. And, you look at the fact that Gorsuch was put in there, Alito was put in there, and a bunch of these who were Kavanaugh put in there. And it almost becomes part of party line votes on all of these things. No wonder the institution that's supposed to be divorced from partisan politics ends up being more partisan than it had ever been. But I think, as you alluded to with the gay rights decision earlier this week on workplace discrimination, to have Gorsuch step in there. And not only did he vote with the liberal bloc, he wrote the opinion. I think that it does prove that in some ways these institutions still work. They're supposed to be divorced from the political winds of the day. And you're not supposed to just be there to be a rubber stamp for whichever president and party puts you on the bench.
Well, let me just quickly step in here, because I have USA Today in front of me.
Okay, give me the info.
But I want to bring it up now, in part because Texas is part of this article at the USA Today. Obama created the program 8 years ago after negotiations with Congress to create a path to citizenship for the young immigrants faltered. Several years later, he sought to extend similar protections to more than 4 million undocumented parents of citizens or lawful permanent residents, but that was shut down by federal courts. Texas then threatened to sue over DACA if the Trump administration didn't end it. When the Department of Homeland Security did so, lawsuits were filed from California to New York and several places in between, and two federal judges blocked the action nationwide. I just wanted to make people understand, Texas then threatened to sue over DACA. How far had Texas gone to the extreme, considering George Bush, considering Rick Perry? I mean, again, one of the arguments I always heard about Rick Perry was, mm-hmm. we've made these investments in their education. Mm-hmm. Why are we doing this? And one of the rationales for allowing them to pursue higher education, one of the rationales in part for DACA is, these kids came when they were kids. Mm-hmm. They didn't have an ability to exercise choice. We have an obligation to educate them. Why take that investment and then throw it away? It just, again, it's shocking, but I'm saddened in a lot of ways that it was 5-4. I'm not surprised. And Roberts wrote the decision, which again, makes a lot of sense. I mean, he very much wants to protect the institution. And he also understands that when things are arbitrary and capricious, you don't validate them.
Yeah, and I think that he understands, and he has taken the rare step at times, Justice Roberts has, speaking out when the court is criticized for its independence. It's supposed to be independent. That's the whole idea, is that you have, and the other thing is, and one of the things that people misunderstand about the court is it's just a co-equal branch of government. They're supposed to be checks on each other. When the executive gets out of control, the legislative branch is supposed to check him. If the legislative branch is out of control, the executive and the courts are supposed to check them. The two other branches of government, whenever one of the branches is veering out of its lane, they're supposed to be like guardrails, right? And that's what they're there for, to keep us on track. And Arnie, on the point about Rick Perry, remember when he ran for president, people like to point to the fact that he couldn't name the three agencies that he wanted to cut if he was, if you know, the oop moment.
I think he's the head of that agency. Isn't he the Department of Energy?
Well, he was. Yeah. Well, he was. Now he just kind of hangs out in the Brenham, Texas area. But I would, and out in Brewster County as well. But I would say that his candidacy was over well before that, because remember, he was nearly booed off the stage during a presidential debate when he was asked about the Texas Dream Act, which all it does is it extends in-state tuition rates to undocumented children in Texas so that they can attend universities here. It's not a free higher education. Mm-hmm. It's just the same break that everybody else gets if they grow up here. And Rick Perry said, "You don't have a heart." He could have simply made and stuck to the economic argument that we've already invested all this money in these kids for the K-12 education. Why wouldn't we want to move them on through the higher education system and get them jobs and to be productive members of society and taxpayers and everything like that? But instead, his gut instinct was to say, "You don't have a heart if you don't think these kids ought to get an education." Because guess what? He really feels that way. The Tea Party did not feel that way, and his candidacy was over. Right. Governor Perry and Governor Bush understood just how intertwined this population is in the state of Texas. And you know what, Arnie? Those kids who were getting on the bus when I was a kid who were not documented, they have gone on and now had children who are documented. And guess what? They're voting. And if you look at the election results and you look at the way that the younger Latinos in the state are trending, what happened in 2017, the sanctuary cities ban in Texas, which was passed at the behest of Governor Abbott, I think is the biggest misstep in the history of Texas politics, potentially. And that's a high bar, by the way. but if you look at the fact that it was California years ago when Republicans were running the place, they passed that anti-immigrant initiative. You remember this? To do away with benefits for undocumented people. It was one of the things that put California on track to be a Democratic stronghold of the state, because guess what? Those people have kids who are documented and they grow up and they don't like the fact that people are against their parents and against their families. And one state senator from Texas who's a Republican told me years ago, he said, "You know, if we don't get right on this issue, it's like a block for every other issue we want to talk about. We are not allowed to talk to Latinos about education, taxes, pro-life, guns, and everything else, because the first thing that they hear us say is that their families don't have a right to be here in the United States."
And on that note, I am so happy that you were here when the DACA decision was released. Again, reminding everyone, Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report, the voice of Texas, Laredo, looking on his cup. And I just want everyone to say, you know, we came on Juneteenth.
Gateway to Mexico.
Airs, and then we're going to end with DACA. It has been a great bookend of a show. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk next week.
Thanks, Arnie.
All right, everyone, stick around. We'll be right back. And, of course, who joins us? Stefan Schmidt, known affectionately as Dr. Politics from Iowa State.
Gardens growing clean water on this current cast. When it rains, the runoff picks up pollution. Fertilizers, herbicides, and oils are carried across hard surfaces, through drains, and into our rivers, lakes, and oceans. Now people are creating rain gardens, directing storm water runoff to shallow depressions in the landscape where it's held long enough to seep into the ground. Pollutants are filtered out or broken down as they move through the soil and into the groundwater supply. With native plants, a rain garden can be a beautiful, low-maintenance, and low-cost way to attract birds and butterflies, too. Your garden may start in the gutter, but it can end up bringing clean water and new life to the land. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. I want to remind everyone that we Zoom our show the day before it airs. This show will air on Juneteenth. You will know that because I will have begun the show reading a very powerful piece at MedPage today about the Juneteenth 2020 movement. Because the show airs Thursday morning, you've just heard Scott Braddock, affectionately known as the Voice of Texas, talk to us about a Supreme Court decision that was just being released about DACA, 5-4 decision. Justice Roberts wrote the decision. We're being joined right now by Stefan Schmidt. Stefan, this has been such an amazing week for the Supreme Court. 5-4 doesn't surprise me about DACA. Obviously, the LGBTQ decision 6-3 with Gorsuch writing it was somewhat of a shock. The decision of the court to not take up a lot of cases was also surprising. They didn't take up Second Amendment cases. They decided not to take up any cases on sanctuary cities. They didn't take up a lot of cop cases when it came to the whole issue of liability. So it was kind of a mixed bag, but in some ways, you know what it was, I think, Stefan? I think it was a very political week. The idea of sanctuary cities, let's see what happens with the 2020 election. The idea of police, let's see what happens with the 2020 election. The idea of, in some ways, what was going on with a number of other cases, I really do see them kind of looking at some of these hot political potatoes and saying these really need to be sort of settled out in the 2020 election. But on the whole idea of the whole DACA case, which really impacts young people's lives right now, and a promise to them that they should come public and then make them vulnerable was just a level of immorality was incredible. And of course, the whole idea is it's a matter of sex. And guess what? LGBTQ is what? A matter of sex. And because of your sex, you should not be denied employment. So a remarkable week, even as we see tragedy happening for the African-American community, and we see interest happening within the Trump administration because of the release of the Bolton book. So I will open the door and say, you pick what's floating your boat because there is so much to talk about it. All of it is worthy.
Well, I mean, it's nothing new. These politicians, presidents and the Senate, they always think when they pick someone who is a liberal, that person then will be a liberal on the court or a conservative will be conservative. The truth of the matter is once you are appointed for life on the Supreme Court, you are influenced by the culture of the court, by what is going on in society, and you're not bound to be consistent with the ideology that the president thought, you know, you were a good choice. And so to me, it is not surprising that conservative justices are saying, you know, our job is to try and make the United States a fair and stable country. How do I rule on this particular thing? Will that help that? Will it hurt it? Will it make the United States the laughingstock of the world, or will it create social unrest? And the Supreme Court is very political. And so you're right. All the issues that have been boiling up over the last 3 years have come to roost a few months before the election on the Supreme Court. And they're looking at hugely important issues. I've had a lot of dreamer students, you know, in my classes at Iowa State. And I must tell you, most of them, I think all of them, were incredibly hardworking, focused, thankful for the opportunity to being in the United States, thankful for being at a great university. They studied hard. They stayed out of trouble. They were great. To kick them out of the country is idiotic. And you know, we might as well start kicking Irish and German immigrants out of the U.S. because they're a pain in the neck.
You're so
and funny. Italians.
And Italians.
The Italians are the biggest pain in the neck, Arnie.
My goombas.
We
spent enough time, I think, not enough, will never be enough time to talk about DACA. I do want to talk a little bit about what just happened with the Bolton book. Part of what bothers me is I want to define the definition of patriotism. I want to define what does it mean to be a traitor. I want to find out what it means to make millions on being a kind of faux traitor or a faux patriot. I am so appalled that when people go into an administration, that it's not just a matter of an appointment, but that they recognize that they are being appointed to a position that has a fiduciary responsibility to their nation and to the citizens of this country. I am not just wild about Bolton, never being willing to testify unless he was subpoenaed. But I am wild that he was privy, took copious notes about what is clearly impeachable offenses, if not traitorous offenses, and that now he gets to make money on not being forthcoming and not protecting the nation he claims to care about.
Yeah, Arnie, look, I have a strangely different point of view, which is another person coming and testifying before the House and saying, you know, this is what I know, wouldn't have made any difference whatsoever, because the Senate was never going to convict Donald Trump. They could have had a video of him, you know, in Times Square shooting a couple of old Jewish women, and the Senate would have still said, well, you know, he had probable cause because they were harassing him. And so I think Bolton's actually, to be honest with you, I think what he has done is more devastating than impeachment. I think what he has done is he has set off basically roadside IEDs on the Trump campaign just a few months before the election. I mean, everybody is talking about, oh, so Donald Trump actually asked that bad president of China, would you please, please buy American agricultural products so that the farm states will vote for me in 2020, whether it's true or not. And I believe Bolton, he's kind of a straight shooter. He's a geek.
Yeah.
That is the most devastating revelation about Bonespur president. I mean, it's incredible, because in Iowa, I don't know about New Hampshire, but in Iowa, they're running ads every single day, multiple times, about how Joe Biden was soft on China. Really hard-hitting ads. Now, those ads are meaningless. Those ads are, you know, are neutralized. And so Bolton, you know, he'll get sued, and then that'll be interesting, because, you know, shutting up people. What is it that Trump is trying to shut up? On the other hand, we will know, because the books are already in the bookstores. What I don't understand is, we are a stupid country. Why don't the bookstores start selling the book this afternoon?
Yeah.
Don't wait until next week to sell it. Sell it this afternoon, and it'll be millions of copies of it. They'll be out there. It'll be impossible to impound them, bring them back, stop them from being sold. You know, do it now, because we want to know what's in it. It's probably interesting. The same, there's a relative of Trump's who has written a book that apparently is incredibly devastating about Trump's personality, the Trump family, money. And Donald Trump has told her, you don't publish that book or I'm going to sue you and I'm going to send you to jail, which he can't do.
He can't do.
You know, there it's a double whammy. It's like a double shotgun. Boom, boom. Two books that are really troublesome for the campaign.
As you were mentioning the ads running in Iowa, you saw the China ad by, what is it called, the Lincoln Project, which is a group of anti-Trump or conservative Republicans who have put together, I will tell you right now, I don't know who the genius is, but their methodology, their advertising, their packaging, their marketing of ammunition against Donald Trump is the most lethal, targeted, smart. I am really in awe of it. They put together a devastating ad about Donald Trump in China. I mean,
it is. And they're also running ads in Iowa against our Republican Senator Joni Ernst. And those ads are also extremely good. And, you know, when your own people, your own clan, your own partisans begin to run ads against you, you got to wonder, you know, what's going on here. And of course, the real story behind all of this, behind it all, is that the Republicans are looking at polls, are looking at President Trump's behavior regarding so many different things, and are going, this could be really bad for us in November, not just for President Trump, whose poll numbers are not good. I mean, it's early, but they're not good. And presidents who were this low in the past generally didn't make it in November. But they're also worried about what that will do to down ticket. You know, your listeners are real smart people. I don't have to explain stuff to them. I know many of them. You know, they're brilliant. They're, you know, all Mensa and stuff like that. And except for a couple that I know who, you know, need to be, you know, probably sent into a cure at a German spa. But the truth of the matter is that really, the Republicans think if President Trump is damaged from independent voters, from disaffected Republicans, not from his base. You know, as his base loves him, he is like a god, and they're never going to abandon him. But there are lots of other people who voted for him.
They're shrinking in number. And actually is a perfect segue to what's happening this weekend. So again, I want to remind everyone that we aired this show on Juneteenth, which is the date that it was originally going to be the event in Tulsa.
Right.
They, for whatever reason, decided to move it to the next day. Oklahoma doesn't really want them to come.
Yes.
Tulsa absolutely doesn't want them to come.
No.
There's a spike in the number of COVID-19. They're being told if they attend this rally that here's what I'm hearing. They're being told that if they attend this rally, they're supposed to sign off on liability if they contract COVID-19. But I thought the pandemic was over. So how do you sign a liability away for something that doesn't exist? But here's the interesting thing. Two things. One, I'm hearing that they may actually move it outside. And their rationale for moving it outside is they got such a huge response from so many thousands and thousands of people.
No.
The physical facility can't handle it.
Right.
I don't know if that's going to happen, but that's what the argument has been.
Correct.
But what is so amazing, so we were talking about what's going on in Tulsa and Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And Pence being in denial and the president being in denial. Someone posted on my Facebook page that they're really glad that the concept of Darwin and the survival of the fittest is going to work. Because he said, all you're doing is you're bringing in all these people who are going to be screaming, who are going to be yelling, who are probably not going to be masking, who are not going to be social distancing.
Right.
That the and so many of Donald Trump's supporters are older white men. Let me repeat this. And as Dr. Fauci said, he's not going anywhere with Donald Trump because he's the demographic that could actually contract COVID and die.
Exactly.
And if you want to describe so many of the people that will be either in that facility or outside even screaming, it is going to be a real problem for Donald Trump. Because what he is doing is that if it turns out that so many of those people contract COVID-19, it will be now his base that will realize that he gave them Kool-Aid and they drank it.
Ooh, that's a metaphor that I don't want to get close to, but yes, it is dangerous. And the thing is, I went to military school, boarding school, because I was a bad boy, in Jacksonville, Florida. Jacksonville. What is going to go on in Jacksonville pretty soon? Donald Trump's acceptance speech.
Right.
I was there on leave in town with some of my classmates, the weekend when the terrible racial conflict erupted, when African Americans were integrating lunch counters at Walgreens and other restaurants, the store owners put out axe handles and baseball bats in boxes for free so that people could get them and go and beat and in many cases kill blacks who were integrating, trying to work on integrating the city. Jacksonville is a powder keg now because they've got that history. It's just like Tulsa, not quite as bad because in Tulsa, they burned down an entire African-American black neighborhood. But there is a history. And I can tell you that when that acceptance speech event goes off in Jacksonville, I wouldn't be surprised if there are lots of protests. What is interesting, and I will repeat it for all of us to understand, this year is so different from the 1960 protests. I was there too in New York when they burned down things and Columbia University was shut and I had tear gas in the room where I was trying to defend my PhD because we were clearing the campus. But those were mostly black students or radical white students that didn't interact with each other. This time around, the crowds, my students have so many black friends and classmates. Some of them have close friends, partners. That makes for a very, very different view and a different mix because it's not blacks against whites. It is people who want justice, better policing, more community justice, and so on, of all races. And that's different.
And again, you can be really angry at Facebook and Google and Amazon and social media and all these things. But what they have done is in real time, given us an experience that you can't avert your eyes.
Yes.
You can't avert your ears. It was always simpler to be able to go back into your white enclave.
Right.
You turn on your CBS News, there's only 4 or 5 TV stations.
Yeah.
So everything was sanitized.
Yeah.
Everything was whitewashed.
And establishment. establishment. Yeah.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
And, Arnie, I have to run.
Not a problem. Not a problem.
Namaste.
All right. See you later. Let me apologize, everyone. Again, I want to remind you, we Zoom on Thursday, so this show can air on Friday. We just lost Stefan Schmidt. Stefan Schmidt was talking to us from his home in Nevada, Iowa. And as he was talking, we could actually hear the plumber in the background because his septic system is bubbling up into his basement. And you and I would both leave a show because of the septic system. So life happens, and that's the virtue of Zoom, is that you get to experience life in real time. But he also sent me something before he left, and we were talking a little bit about Bolton's book. And let me just say something. I think Stefan is absolutely right. Maybe it would have been a waste if Bolton had said something during the impeachment hearing. Maybe I can be disgusted with him, and yet maybe at the same time, I can be happy with him. Maybe I can think he wasn't a patriot. Maybe I can think he was kind of on the verge of being a bit of a traitor because he knew so much and wasn't forthcoming. But the timing of his book, a couple of months before an election, during a time of a pandemic, during the time of an economic downturn, where we're seeing the numbers already cratering for Donald Trump, maybe having waited to release this book now is of value. So let me read to you a statement that Stefan made. He was asked by a reporter to comment on Bolton's book. And so he shared with me what he shared with that reporter. So I'm going to read it to you. And he writes exactly this. He's talking to the reporter. Thanks for contacting me. Glad you're well. We're on a farm and hope to stay well as well. Bolton is the symbol, and he writes that in capital letters, of conservative Republicans. He is adored by the core of the establishment. Trump dissed Bolton and fired him. Revenge, this is close to an election, is sweet gobsmack at Trump. I think the revelation that is most damaging to Trump is that he asked the leader of China to buy more soybeans and other agricultural products so Trump could win the 2020 election. Of course, he's talking from Iowa, everyone. So of course, as soon as you talk about buying products from anywhere, you're talking Iowa. And of course, he's talking to Xi about buying the products, not because Iowa should be selling them to them, because it'll help them, because it'll buy their votes. Oh my God, where's my middle finger? Anyway, let me continue. And then he writes, wow, that is Trump campaign's biggest attack on Biden. He's soft on China. Many ads are already on our cable news every day in Iowa. Yes, this is going to hurt Trump with independent voters, including Republicans who worry about Trump and his impact on US democracy. I don't know how many of those are left. True Trumpists will not care, but it is a terrible setback, coupled with all the other books that are about to come out. COVID, the economy, the polls already show Republican and Trump's weakness. Best Stefan. As you can tell, he's right. The timing of the Bolton book is probably better now if I care about an election in November. Am I still furious with Bolton? Absolutely. Is this a win-win for him? Yes. He's going to make millions. He's going to look like he helped remove Trump. And he's going to do something that Biden couldn't do, but clearly only he could do, which is to undermine Trump on his China position. So who knows? All right, everyone. The show airs on June 19th, Juneteenth. I get a link to a site called MedPage Today. MedPage Today is a site that's designed for physicians and nurses and healthcare professionals, and it gives them, it shares information about new techniques, it shares information about new drugs, it gives them information about studies, but it also includes other information that have some kind of a healthcare nexus. Well, this was an article at MedPage Today about Juneteenth, 2020. It's written by Lash Nolan. Lash Nolan is an activist, a writer, and also a first-year medical student at Harvard Medical School. And I wanted to read what Lash Nolan wrote, because the fact that it was in a healthcare journal is, I think, an important connection for all of us. So without Lash's permission, I will have edited it out, so it will not be the entire article. I'm hoping it's okay that we read Lash's piece. I suspect it is. Juneteenth, 2020, a movement beyond a moment. It's time for everyone in healthcare to reflect and act. Remember this. Juneteenth is the oldest national celebration of the abolishment of slavery in the United States. The holiday commemorates the arrival of Major General Gordon Granger on June 19, 1865 in Galveston, Texas, when he announced the end of the Civil War and slavery. President Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation attempted to abolish slavery more than 2 years earlier, but his message was not completely translated into action. It would take a civil war to effectively end slavery in the United States, and even after the war ended, many slave owners purposely withheld the news from their slaves. This, coupled with the limited communication among slaves, allowed slavery to continue in Texas and other states. It was not until Major Granger's announcement that the chains that kept Black Texans in bondage were finally broken. His announcement was met with emotions that ranged from shock to jubilee. Black people took to the streets to celebrate their newfound freedom, a privilege that wasn't granted to them on July 4th, 1776. 155 years later, Juneteenth continues to be a major fixture in Black culture. On June 19th of every year, celebrations range from pageants to block parties in Black communities across the nation. But like many Black youth, I didn't learn about Juneteenth in primary school or my advanced placement history class. I was educated to Black history by my family, and they were the educators that taught me about the critical happenings of our fight for liberation. June 19th has always been marked on Black people's calendars, but this year is the first time it showed up on Google's calendar, and seemingly those of many non-Black Americans. Major companies like Nike and Twitter have recently released statements announcing the recognition of the holiday. These changes come after a new wave of public statements denouncing racism and promises to, quote, do better. After the tragic murders of Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Tony McDade, all unarmed Black people who were killed by the fatal strike of racism. She did not include Mr. Brooks because that had happened after she'd already written the piece. While the national recognition of Juneteenth marks progression in race relations in our country, we would be remiss not to recognize the immense amount of suffering it took for us to arrive at this inflection point. Racism has become the national conversation in America, and it is largely due to the staggering disparities revealed by COVID-19, augmented by the back-to-back brutal murders of Black people broadcast on screens across the country. This level of pain and agony is what it took for America to seriously consider the value of Black lives, for medical schools and hospitals to truly invest in the work of offices for diversity and inclusion, for leaders to value the promotion and tenure of Black professors, for institutions to find strategies to become better neighbors in the communities they inhabit, for educators to reconsider how they present statistics on health disparities, for the medical institution to recognize its own complicity in systemic racism, for us to recognize as a community that anti-racism is the only way forward. For this reason, we should not be too quick to applaud the cursory erection of Juneteenth celebrations and observations. We must consider that the president of our country was completely unaware of its existence, and that it took public outrage for him to reschedule a rally to be held on Juneteenth in Tulsa, the site of one of the most violent racial attacks on Black people in US history. We must ponder how this ignorance might reflect the way we are taught American history, what narratives are left untold, and how this lack of knowledge perpetuates systemic racism in medicine and beyond. As healthcare professionals and students, it should be a vital imperative for us to understand history as it relates to the context of our patients and community members' lives. Our role as healers and important pillars in our community make it so that we have a heightened responsibility to understand history and the medical institution's role in it. We can no longer ignore historical happenings, good and bad, that shape our society today, because this history is deeply connected to the humanity of each of our patients and our community. So I challenge us to make this Juneteenth a day of reflection and action, a time for us to reflect on why it took so long for our country to recognize the importance of Juneteenth, though it took the rest of America far too long to celebrate the most important commemoration of our liberation. I am elated the time has finally arrived. Now it is up to our allies to ensure that this moment of celebration grows into a movement that spans beyond Juneteenth and into the rest of their lives as advocates for justice. Lash Nolan is an activist, writer, and first-year student at Harvard Medical School. Her commentary on social justice and health equity has been featured on NPR, Teen Vogue, and Undark magazines. Thank you, Nash. And with that, I'm going to say au revoir to the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stay safe. We'll talk next week. You Thanks.